Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber with Everyone Loves Guitar. We're going to show some love to the rhythm section today. I've got one of the best metal bassists in the world, actually, on this show, with Björn Englund. He is from Sweden. In 1994, he became the bass player for Quiet Riot, which, of course, was the first heavy metal group to reach number one on Billboard, and he toured with them in 1995. Shortly after that, he formed the group Soul Sign. They've toured the U.S. and Europe. Their current lineup includes Ted Nugent, Rock Vault, vocalist Mark Bowles, and they're currently working on a second full-length album. In the late 90s to mid-2000s, Björn worked extensively as an L.A. session bassist. He recorded with members of Elton John, Heart, The Supremes, Alice Cooper, Sweet, Dio, and Paul Rodgers, just to name a few. When's the last time The Supremes, Dio, and Elton John were mentioned in the same sentence? I salute you, man. That's awesome. From 2004 to 2006, Björn joined forces with Michael Schenker Group and survival vocalist Robin McCauley. And from 2007 to 12, he was the bass player for guitar icon Yngwie Malmsteen. I should just say Yngwie. Everybody knows who he is. Touring all over the world. From 2011 to 17, Björn worked with guitar keyboard virtuoso Tony McAlpine, again touring worldwide. And in 2012, he joined Dio Disciples, featuring longtime Dio members Craig Goldie, Simon Wright, and Scott Warren. Occasionally, he also plays with Scorpions guitar legend Uli John Roth. In 2011, he was concurrently working with three of the biggest guitar gods of all time, which is, of course, Uli, Tony McAlpine, and Yngwie. In April of 2015, he joined the brand new power metal group called Black Welder. Their debut album received sky-high reviews worldwide and actually reached top of the charts in Japan. Björn spent a lot of time educating upcoming bass players and musicians. He's done numerous clinics and masterclasses worldwide. He's a sought-after session bassist, and he estimates to have performed on over 50 albums and played nearly 2,000 live shows. Wow. He's recorded and performed with members of Foreigner, Deep Purple, Kiss, again, The Supremes, David Lee Roth, Ozzy, Elton John, Dio, Rainbow, Journey, Korn, Dream Theater, Whitesnake, Heart, Judas Priest, Guns N' Roses, Sweet, Steve Vai, George Lynch, Vixen, Buddy Guy, Alice Cooper, Paul Rodgers, and more. That's like the entire metal section of like my record collection. Man, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
Hey, I've interviewed a lot of great guitarists from Sweden, and Sweden just seems like a real hotbed of great musicians and is super creative over there. And there's especially like a lot of 1970s sort of, you know, good old fashioned hard blues rock. And I was curious, why is that in your opinion? Why does Sweden have so many good players? And, you know, what about that era is so popular?
Well, I think that Sweden have a lot of good players, but I think that like Yngwie set the bar high, first of all, and he's Swedish, so people were like, if he can do it, we can do it. And I think that's a big one. Then you had ABBA, that has a little bit of an effect. I think as far as, you know, people that played on those records are really good players, and that also influences people. But I think that Sweden's just less trendy as far as you know, like, for example, America or California or Los Angeles, where I live and where I've been for 25 years, it's been like, you know, you're around the whole trend of music and the flavor of the week and all that stuff. Back when I grew up in the 70s and 80s, there were no record labels almost in Sweden at all as far as, you know, internationally successful record labels. So people were more down to the roots, I think, and they weren't affected by you know, the flavor of the week kind of thing. Like, I think people probably have been in America, I think, you know, because of the trends are stronger and, you know, hey, well, when grunge got big, everybody started playing grunge and stuff like that. Europe wasn't like that. And I think that the rest of the world wasn't like that. And because I think America was just really kind of pushing that through whether it was like VH1 or MTV and all that stuff, as an example, and whatever was available on the, you know, in the record stores, and so forth. But as far as the 70s blues, that's a good question. Maybe because Sweden's closer to England geographically these days, geographical differences really don't matter as much. But I think back then, you know, like my friends, and especially my friends that are older than me, like they, you know, they keep telling me about how they used to go to London to buy records and that kind of thing. And I think what was available over there was probably more the blues kind of, you know, rootsy kind of stuff. And, you know, so I think that probably played a big role in it too. But it's a good question. And I get that all the time. Like, and they're like, why, how come people are good players and stuff like that from Sweden and Scandinavia? And I think part of it is there's many different reasons. My theory is a little bit, part of it might be the weather, that where people, like, you know, you're inside more and you less outdoor activities during the winter, especially. But I think also work ethics, where you're in one band and, you know, I think people anywhere in the world, when you're a kid, most people are like in one band for at least for a while, for a few years growing up. And it's kind of like you don't play with other bands because it's kind of like you're cheating on your band kind of thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, you know, if band rehearsal was Monday, Thursday, it was every Monday, Thursday, religiously. And you just didn't skip band rehearsal. And I think I talked to other people too, like my friends and bands growing up, like In Flames and, you know, Hammerfall and all these successful Swedish metal bands. You know, how they were growing up was the same. They grew up in the same city, same neighborhood sometimes. Mm. They were buddies. They were high school buddies. They were elementary school buddies sometimes. And they just kind of got to know each other and build from there and stuck with one band. And I think not only do you have more success with that project, but I think in a sense you kind of you give yourself a chance to grow as a musician too, a lot. Maybe in a different way. I mean, as far as with structure and discipline, you do. But as far as there's a whole different world of how I kind of grew up since I was 21 years old and being in L.A., I kind of went the other route as a session player, and I played with, you know, 1,000 different bands and gigs and styles of music. And that's a way to kind of broaden your playing. And not only are you able to, in any situation in your life, support yourself as a musician, but also, even if you want to only be a metal bass player, it'll make you a better metal bass player. Be, you know, playing blues and playing Latin, playing jazz, playing everything, and listening to everything. So, kind of got off the subject there a little bit.
But, no, it's all good, man. Do you know Christian Carlson?
Don't think so.
He's a guy I interviewed in Sweden. He's from a band called The Quill. They've been around, oh, probably 25 years. I was just curious because he was telling me, you know, they're all like from their little towns still. They're living there and they're all like all these, exactly what you said. They all grew up together and they're still in a relatively small town and they're kind of like just do their thing. You know, they've been together 25 years and they've produced, I don't know, 9, 10, 12 albums, but it's just interesting.
Yeah, and a big difference too, I'd like to mention, like when I came here, I realized that people don't rehearse as much. People aren't as picky, you know, as far as rehearsing 20 times before a show. It's more like throw and go, and you kind of, sometimes you learn songs on stage, especially if it's like a, you know, a cover band or something like that. You know, you get thrown stuff at you on stage. People improvise a lot more. They leave more room for, you know, let's see what the audience is like. Let's see how long I'm going to play the song for. And I notice even to this day, whenever I go back and work in Sweden, and do and everything has to be planned out. They don't leave any room for, you know, risks or, you know, or and to me, it's that's scary for me because I like the other way around. What much more because I'm kind of accustomed to that.
Sure. I think that's in I noticed that in business too, like if I've talking to people like in other countries and you know, Germany comes to mind, for example. They're very more of a rigid culture of, you know, this has to, I think, I don't want to say standards are higher, but I think perfection is the goal, whereas the goal is performance here, which is a little different, you know, so I totally get that.
I feel like you're right, whether it's business or music or any art and like that, there's more room for the vibe factor here as opposed to, like you said, perfection. Just make sure the energy and the vibe and everybody getting along and all that is the focus is more on that, it seems like.
Yeah, and it's so, and there's so many people here too that like sometimes it's only vibe where like you have something that whether it's music, art, whatever, it's like a lot of people might say, man, that's really weird, but there's enough people that are like grooving on that one thing where it could be a big seller, you know, kind of thing. And it's just, it's applies to a niche, but you know, hey, we got 350 million people in this country. So it doesn't matter. You don't really have to have 50% of them to do well, you know? So that's interesting.
That's very true. That's a good way to look at it too, for sure.
What prompted you to leave and come here in the first place? And this was back in 94, you said, right?
93. Growing up and, you know, I started thinking about it probably when I was 18, 19 already. And I moved when I was about 21. And, it was just, I mean, I lived in a smaller town, smaller city. And there was maybe some more opportunities moving to, you know, Gothenburg or Stockholm or something like that. More people to play with, more choices of, you know, musicians. Although I played with good musicians where I was, it's just I didn't feel like they had the same goals. And
in what way?
I just could tell that they necessarily didn't believe in themselves, maybe, or they thought that, you know, they kind of in their mind limited themselves. I mean, I don't think I had the conversation with them, but I could just tell that. And for me, it wasn't even an option. Plan B wasn't even an option. As I turned 15, I knew what I wanted to do, and there's nothing that's going to stop me. And I think that's the attitude you got to have. And part of it too was there was really no labels back then in Sweden. There was some. And the fact that grunge kicked in didn't really hit me so hard because it didn't show as much in Sweden. So, you know, I played more the traditional classic rock and metal, but that wasn't even a factor. It was more the fact that there's no labels, very few bands got signed. It was very, very difficult to stay in Sweden and become successful. I mean, the band Europe did it, but pretty much nobody else did it, you know, and even the bands that did get signed by back then CBS or whatever, Virgin and stuff like that, were kind of came to a halt when they tried to get the band promoted through the U.S. offices. They were kind of shut down. And, you know, some people explained that to me later why that might have been, you know, because there were two different entities, it seemed like, you know, you got CBS Europe or Scandinavia, and you have CBS U.S., and they didn't really care to work with each other too much. So
it happens. That's why I've heard this with everybody, even within the country, you have like Atlantic West and Atlantic East or something like that. And it was like, you know, both sides were like not working together. It was like competing almost with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I heard too was like, if CBS US would bring a band over from Scandinavia, they wouldn't get credit for it. So that they wouldn't do it. You know, CBS Scandinavia, they would get credit for it or something like that. That, oh man, you brought up this band or whatever. So, so there was a lot of that. So I was just like, well, you know what? I got to move, and I can move to Stockholm. I can move to London, but I'm like, you know, I might as well try LA. And I had heard about, you know, how some Swedish musicians would come here, and a couple, not many. And I had a friend who came. He was a really talented guitar player. He came over and I talked to him. I talked to another friend of mine from New York that met a girl from my hometown, and he moved back with her to Sweden. And he told me about his story about trying to make it in LA and stuff like that. And, you know, they both warned me about, you know, there's a lot of drugs, be careful, there's a lot of this and that.
Oh, that's right. There's no drugs in Sweden, is there?
Well, I think now there's some meth and stuff like that. It's getting popular. But back then, really, no. I mean, you'd have to be in really grungy, like, groups of people to even be exposed to that.
That's amazing. That's great, yeah. Man. And your rules over there, I don't want to get off subject, but your I don't know if it's Sweden, but I've read studies that the drug problem over there, you know, they just basically legalized a lot of drugs, which, like, I don't know if it's Sweden, but one of the countries in Eastern Europe, in Northern Europe, sorry.
Legalized. It might be Denmark. Denmark or Holland. I don't think Sweden. Sweden, I think, is very, very strict.
Are they?
Yeah. And it's funny because there's a cough medicine you can buy that has no side effects, and it shuts in Sweden, an over-the-counter cough medicine that has no side effects and shuts off the cough reflex in your brain. And I've always wondered why it's not sold in a lot of other places in the world. And I read up on it, and it apparently has a form of opium in it.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, that's.
But it's not. I mean, it originally does, but, you know, then it changes as the chemical progress process goes on in the factory. So it's no longer. It doesn't have that formula, but it originally has. It's made with opium, some form of opium.
Yeah, it's just a different. I know things are different. Like I said, one of the Northern European countries, they've got. I think they legalized a lot of drugs, and it remediated a lot of the problems where, like, you know, you have an area where everybody that uses drugs hanging out, and, like, you just don't go there if you're not into drugs. I don't know. It just seems like their approach to things is.
Yeah. That's Denmark. Denmark.
Yeah.
Hagen, Denmark. There's an area, Christiania is the area. And it's actually pretty cool. I mean, it's got a lot of cool cafes and restaurants and stuff like that. But yeah, it's been like that for a long time, where they kind of keep it under control that way. And to them, it made a lot of sense. And you know, Danish people and Danish government and all that stuff, they make a lot more sense than Sweden, for sure. And in a lot of ways, their mentality is just more realistic, and they're more internationally progressed and stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like that. Like here, unfortunately, you always have different factions, and it's all about money. Like, who's gonna, you know, it's. I don't want to get this whole political, but you know, it's just fucking nutty here. Anyway, So let me ask you this: you said a couple of things I wanted to talk about. You said, "Hey, I knew what I wanted to do, and nothing was going to stop me." Where did you get that sort of a mindset from? Because I think that's a lot. It took a lot of courage as an 18, 19 year old kid to start thinking about that, and at 21 to move over here. I mean, looking back, you know, you look at, I know a 21 year old kid in there is probably more mature than a 21 year old kid here, especially nowadays, but nevertheless, it's a pretty cool thing to think about that and to actually execute, man. Where did you get that mindset from of, you know, hey, this is what I want. I'm going to do it. I'm not afraid.
Right.
Did you come from a family of entrepreneurs or?
Not at all. I didn't come from any family of music or anything like that. And it was almost like, they didn't want me to, I mean, didn't say it, but it wasn't like encouraged at all. Like, oh yeah, go out and play rock and roll and tour the world, you know.
And move to America.
Right. I think they were hoping I'd come back home after about a year, which I did, to visit, and then I went straight back again. I think I didn't know what to be afraid of, and I think that the fear wasn't there because I hadn't experienced a lot of stuff yet, so that was a good thing. And I think I felt like, well, I had a lot to learn, I had to gain a lot more experience as a player, but I still felt like, hey, I was playing along with records, playing in bands, and I could play some of the, you know, not super sophisticated necessarily stuff, but I could play. I was a pretty good, solid player, and I felt like, you know, I had somewhat good stage presence, and I kind of felt like, you know, I have what it takes, you know. And so for me, it was just like, I kind of just knew that it's up to me, you know. I can stop myself, or I can make this happen. And I didn't know how. I just knew that, hey, you just got to throw yourself in the out there and get to know people and make the best of it, you know.
Dude, I give you a lot of credit. I smell motivational seminar, Bjorn. That's seriously.
I do a lot of that when I do clinics. I talk to kids and, you know, because they ask a lot about, you know, how are things in the U.S., if I am in Europe doing clinics, and, you know, if I'm here, they're like, you know, they ask about how did I grow up and what was it like touring with this and that person. And, you know, because they're, you know, they're wondering too, like, what was scary? They don't come straight out and say that, but
yeah,
they tell us where they're coming from. They go like, well, where does the courage come from? And how do I go about it? And how are the first steps? And I think that's kind of like, you know, a lot of people ask themselves that. I think anything in life, I think baby steps is the key. You know, you kind of, you know, you just make the steps in the right direction, and then you kind of just, you figure it out. You know, it's like opening a business. You don't rent out like a huge office.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you start with an idea and your laptop on a desk, and that's it. You know?
Yeah. So. No, totally. No, but I think it's very true. You said the fear of how you do things, in my experience, is always much greater than the actual execution of doing it. And then usually you do it and you're like, shit, what was I? This is really a lot easier. Not easy, but like, you know, I didn't need to be afraid of all this crap, whatever you're doing.
And I think fear is the biggest obstacle, because I'm sure we've all heard like bands and artists, you know, that are successful, and you go like, how the heck did this band get there? Like, they're really not even that good. And I think it's just like, there's no self-doubt. They have goals and they have no fear. That's it.
Yeah, I agree with you, man.
And I think that's a lot of it, you know? So
when you first came here, how'd you go about getting work? Like, you literally knew nobody in LA, right?
I didn't. Well, I knew one guy, and, he was a bass player in a band that I used to have this magazine, this fanzine, when I was a kid, and I would interview bands and bands that came to town. And
that's really cool.
I would write to their managers and fan clubs and all kinds of stuff and get, you know,
response. Dude, you're super like motivated. That's awesome.
Yeah. So this started when I was like 13, and I had this magazine till I was like 17, you know, and, I got to know some people that, you know, that I talk to now. They're booking agents and they're, you know, famous musicians and stuff like that. And a lot of these people remember me, and we're friends now, and we play gigs together sometimes, and they book my bands and stuff like
that's
that.
That's so cool.
Yeah, because they, you know, they looked at me as this little kid that was writing to them when I was 13, and they were probably like 20, 25, and they're like, you know, kind of thought it was kind of like, you know.
Cute. That's funny, so, man. That's awesome.
So it shows you how small the world is, but
amazing.
Yeah. So I had this magazine. This band came to town to play in my hometown, and I interviewed them and everything. And I got the tour poster, and I put it on my wall. They were on a huge band, but they were really good. And so I remembered what everybody looked like. And then about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years fasting forward, I'm working at the local music store, and I walk in. I came back from lunch, and I walk in, and this guy is sitting down on the floor playing this acoustic bass, and I look at him, and he dyed his hair. It was blonde, but his you know, dark brown in the picture. And I look at him, and I'm going like, hey, you're the bass player from the band, or Blacksmith was the name of the band. And he looked at me going like, how the hell do you know that? And I told him the story of like 7 years before I interviewed his band, and he thought it was hysterical. You know, we became friends, and
that's
he
cool.
Moved to LA, and, you know, I talked to him, and he goes like, yeah, man, it's great. And, you know, I'm on the roof, you know, and the sun hanging out by the pool. And I'm like, that's it. That's all I need.
Sun and pool, you're done, right?
Yeah. And it was like March in Sweden. And it's like, you know, we still had snow on the ground. I'm like, dude, that's it. I'm going.
Good for you.
That was a deal breaker. And I'd been to LA like, you know, 2 years before for 4 days, just driving all over the place in a convertible car, me and a buddy. And we were just like, what a cool place. So yeah. That was it. So.
Very cool, man. And how'd you get work when you first got there? So you knew this one dude from Blacksmith.
Yeah. Well, I slept on his couch for a couple of weeks, got my own apartment. Speaking of Germany, I had found a German roommate, a friend. And I was actually taking classes at the Musicians Institute. So I signed up for that before. So that's how I got my visa to stay.
Very cool, man.
Yeah. And it was a good school too. I mean, you know, I studied some reading and some, played some, you know, styles of music that I probably wouldn't play otherwise. as much, at least. So that was good. So
you're pretty organized. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You seem like you're pretty organized.
I think I was more organized when I was a kid. I was extremely organized. People, you know, kind of made fun of me, but I got more, in my own opinion, less organized as I got older. And
well, you got more shit to do.
Yeah, there's more stuff. And stuff gets messy. And yeah, it's just like my mind gets messy and all that stuff.
I hear you, man.
But yeah.
So you went to musicians, so you got your visa. So you're working, you're going to school. You probably had some job after school.
I did. I was working at a 24-hour gym, actually, just so I could stay and you know, make ends meet. Hmm. I was working the graveyard shift a lot. And I was talking to people coming in and out of the gym. And there was this two girls from Australia that really liked to talk a lot. And they would talk. And then one of the girls came in one night and she had the LA Weekly entertainment guide in her hand. And she said, "Check this out. Quiet Riot's looking for a bass player." And she threw the paper on my desk. And I'm like, "Well, I don't know about that, because they changed members." And it was maybe Carlos was still in the band, and maybe Frankie. And they kind of, you know, it was back and forth. But it wasn't like, yeah, I didn't recognize many people in the photos, because I've seen them playing around town, you know, 1 or 2 years previous to that. And they started getting back together around that time. And so I was like, well, you know, and she's like, "Well, you know, it's the original lineup getting back together." And I was reading this article, and then like, "Oh, and then there's an address. Well, if you're interested, you know, they're looking for a bass player. They're getting together with the original members, but, you know, Rudy Sarso won't be able to make it. So, you know, you can send in your demo and a picture here," or whatever, you know. I did, and then Kevin DeBro called me back, and that was pretty crazy,
you know? Dude, that had to make you feel like $1 million, like your first gig is with Quiet Riot.
It did, and it was the thing. It's like, I keep telling people, it's all about who you know. But in fact, the very first gig I got, like the first big gig, I didn't know anybody in the band, which is extremely rare. And I guess they just had this cattle call audition of like 40 people, and I think they got 120 demo tapes.
Wow.
And they out of those, they selected 40 people to come in and play two songs. And so they pretty much asked me right away, and then to tour with them. And I was like, "Whoa, this is pretty cool." So
like, did you call home and you're like telling your buddies like, "Hey, I'm in Quiet Riot now"? They must have been like, "You're fucking lying."
You know what? I was afraid to tell people. I didn't tell almost anybody till like the tour started. I just kind of said, "Well, what if I say this and then it doesn't happen?
Sure.
I'm going to look like an ass."
Yeah, know? Yeah, I totally get
you
that.
You know, so I was afraid to tell people, and I think I started telling people when I was, you know, I played the first show with them or something like that. But yeah,
that is so cool, man. You auditioned and you got called out of 120 people. That's great, man.
Yeah.
Talk about, I'm going to throw out some artist names. If you could talk about how you got the gig, and maybe if you have a cool or interesting story about working with them. Let's talk about Uli John Roth first.
Okay. Oh, it's a cool story about, well, he's a very unique person and really cool guy. I really enjoy playing with him because he likes to improvise a lot, and it really suits me, you know, as far as you don't really know where he's going to go. He usually doesn't have a set list. You know,
That's interesting.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And, so I enjoy that a lot. And he's when I first jammed with him, he said, you know, "Hey, you're one of the greatest bass players I've ever played with." And we only played one song together. And I'm like, "Wow." And he said, "No, I'm serious," he said. And so that was really flattering.
Yeah.
And then I ended up playing I don't know how many shows, but a bunch of shows with him through, you know, like the period of like, you know, 3 years, something like that.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Very cool. I listened to those early Scorpions records. Like, they were such a great, I mean, to me, that's the best version of the band back in the day. You know, I love them.
It's a very different version of the band, I would say.
Yeah. I like the lots of the improv, some of the spacey stuff they did. I like 7-minute songs. You know, that was like right up my alley, man. So, you know, Fly to the Rainbow, and that was, you know, one of my favorite records ever.
Wonderful pieces, definitely.
Deep Purple, which version, and like how'd you get that gig, and cool story?
Well, I played with When I was in Engbe's band, we did a tour with Deep Purple in Japan and opening up for Deep Purple. It was sort of like a headlining tour. And the first show in Tokyo, and I felt like we never really rehearsed that much with Engbe. It was kind of like, well, everybody knows the songs. We didn't even play all the songs in rehearsal. You know, it was like more checking out the gear, maybe playing through stuff maybe once. Somebody made a mistake. He stopped, and we never played that song again. So it was kind of like you just had to know your stuff. And I felt like, well, I feel a little rusty, you know. We hadn't toured in a few months, but 6 months, I think, we hadn't toured. So we get to Tokyo on the first show, and I play like 2-3 songs, and I look over to the right, and there's two people standing at the, you know, side of the stage. And I look again, and it's Steve Morse and Roger Glover.
Wow.
I'm
like, not too much pressure.
Yeah. Like, oh, geez. You know, so that's all I need. You know, and it was funny. And then Engbe starts his first short solo, whatever, after about a few songs, 3-4 songs, something like that. So I walk off and, you know, I shake their hands, and they're like, oh, yeah, it's really nice to meet you. And they're like, oh, this is sounding great, man, and all that stuff. And there were such nice, humble guys. And I'm like, wow, so cool. So
you almost wanted to tell them, hey, you guys, you know who you are, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Most of the guys that I've met, whether it's in, you know, interviewing all these guys in music or in business, the most successful guys are generally the nicest, and that's part of, I think, why they became successful. I think there's a 100%. myth yeah. about these successful, in like I said, whether it's business, music, these guys are assholes. I think that's like very extreme, exaggerated behavior from a small quadrant.
Yeah.
Of people, you know, it's almost like saying in any religion, oh, these guys are really fanatics. Well, they probably are, but that's a real small percentage
I do know of people, and no names, obviously, but I do know of a handful of people that I know, I could tell that they know when to be nice, and they do a pretty good job of acting nice to the right people.
Sure.
So I know a few of those, but
sure.
But for the very most part, you're right about that. Definitely. Yeah,
so it seems.
Yeah, and you can tell if somebody's a nice person genuinely. You know,
it's pretty easy. You don't have to be like a Sherlock Holmes to figure it out. You know, they're either very nice or they're not. Or like you said, you could tell when, you know, your bullshit meter goes up pretty quick when someone's laying it on, and it's like, it's just like, save it, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead, absolutely. Man. I apologize. So Steve Morse Roger Glover, they talk with you, and they're really praising you and getting along well.
Yeah, very much so. Very nice guy. So that's a really nice memory of you know, working with Deep Purple. And another time, my second show with Engbe was in Russia, and Jolyn Turner was there playing with his band. And Engbe said, hey, why don't you sit in and do like 5 or 6 songs with us? We can do like Pictures of Home, which I hadn't played in. Forget who I played it with back in the – I played it with somebody years ago, like 10 years before that. I didn't remember the song. Never played it since. And Engbe said, let's play the song, you know, goes in B, whatever. I'm like, okay. And so I played it with that, and, you know, that was a rough one. But so we did that, and we did a few songs of the album that Jolyn Turner sang on with Engbe. So in the dressing room, and Joe goes, well, we can do these songs, but I don't remember the lyrics. And I said, well, I do. I have them on my iPod. So I'm sitting at the table, and I'm writing down the lyrics for Joe and Turner. Joe is sitting on one side of me and Engbe on the other side, and I'm going like, this is too weird. Because you know, it goes right back to the when I was a kid, when I was like 16, 17 years old, when that album came out. Mm. I'm playing and I'm learning the songs in my room or whatever. And I was like, well – if somebody said, hey, you're going to play with these guys one day, I'd probably believe them. But if somebody said, well, one day you're going to sit and write the lyrics for Jolyn Turner, and Engbe's going to sit on one side and watch Joe on the other side, I'd be like, come on, that's not going to happen. But I kind of had to pinch myself.
Good
that
for
was
you.
Weird. Because I really looked up to both of them, you know, growing up and stuff like that. So, and Joe was in Deep Purple briefly. So that's another Deep Purple story.
Very cool, man. Very cool.
So
how about Elton John? What was the deal with that?
Well, I worked and recorded with the drummer of I don't even remember his last name. I think his first name was Joe, and he was with Elton John for I don't know how long. if you say his last name, I can probably.
The only drummer I know is, I think his name was Nigel. That was like from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. That was way the hell back.
Yeah. So I don't know how long he played with him or whatever, but yeah. So, and I do actually, when I worked at the school up in Agoura Hills, California, and it was like this after school program with kids and adults all ages, and it was kind of like a school of rock kind of thing. And we did a theme where we did all Elton John songs, and the kids were supposed to do a concert. And then for, you know, at the end of the night, Elton John's entire band gets on stage and the kids get to jam with them. So that was
pretty cool. Wow, that is cool.
And I'm thinking, like, when you're 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, can you really grasp that what this is? I mean, it's I don't know. And I'm thinking, like, these kids are so spoiled. I'm like, I couldn't even dream of that when I was their age.
Yeah, that's – and he's like one of the most creative forces in rock and that for his era, you know, for sure. He's done a lot. Really right. Smart guy. And then Dio, man.
Well, I met Dio, but I never really got to know Dio at all. And then, briefly after coming to LA, I got to know Craig Goldie, and we've been friends ever since, became good friends. And he's always been really supportive of me and encouraging and stuff like that. So when Dio Disciples, you know, after Ronnie passed, the guys decided to carry on the band without him and call it Dio Disciples. And when they needed a bass player, Craig asked me to join the band and stuff like that. So that was pretty cool, you know.
Very cool.
It's almost like being in Dio, you know. So and you know, we're still touring and we're still playing shows and stuff like that. So it's a very cool thing, you know. Great guys, obviously great musicians and stuff like that. So we're actually working on an album now that we're gonna.
Very cool. When is it coming out?
I don't think we have a release date yet, but we're going to be hopefully tracking this fall. And
that's great, man.
Yeah, so
that's fantastic. Yeah. That's good.
That's the plan, at least. So we'll see what happens.
I've met a few people who did get to work with Ronnie, and everybody said he was one of the nicest guys they'd ever met. He was such a sweet guy.
Yeah. So. Yeah. He's really definitely has that reputation for sure. Yeah.
Are you still doing session work, or are you just touring now, or both?
I do session work, obviously not as much at studios, you know, in Los Angeles like I used to do, for obvious reasons, but I do a lot here out of my house, just playing on tracks for people all over the world, which is a cool thing. You know, I'll get a, you know, email from a guy in Brazil that says, hey, I want you to play on two songs, and the next day a guy in Korea, and the next day is a guy in Russia, and it's like it's pretty amazing, you know.
Very cool, man. So
it's very cool, man.
Are you working on anything now that you're excited about in particular?
Well, I'm working on a follow-up album with my band Soul Sign, the second album, and also working on song ideas for Dio Disciples and stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty stoked about that. And, so always keep my ears open, mind open to whatever
you see out there. You seem like a hustler, man. I don't think you're probably sitting still too much.
You know, kind of a little bit of both. I mean, it's kind of like I either work too hard or sometimes I go like, well, you know, maybe I should, you know, but sometimes you got to rest in between.
You do, man.
Travel and all that stuff too. So I try to balance things more now, I think, than before.
That's great. Instead
of just go. I realize, well, sometimes you got to stop and take a break and stuff like that. So.
You are 100% right, man. That's super important. And I need to do that better job of that. Would it be possible for you to pick like the top three musical experiences you've had for one, whether it's, you know, your particular playing, you know, the hang, just the music itself, because you've done so many different projects. What would be your knee jerk reaction to like top three?
Well, working with my own band, Soul Sign, and recording and performing and all the great musicians and friends that have been in the band and are in the band, it's definitely a very enjoyable experience. So that would be one, obviously. And, you know, as far as working and doing, you know, like touring and shows and stuff like that. I mean, when we played, we closed off the Wacken Festival in 2016 with Dio Disciples and doing the Ronnie James Dio Hologram. That was pretty cool, to say the least. That was a very nice experience. Obviously, working with Yngwie Malmsteen was incredible. I mean, working with Tony McAlpine, Uli John Roth, everybody else was amazing. Yngwie was my the first, you know, guitar god that I worked with, and he was kind of a groundbreaking kind of stylistically player and stuff like that. And after growing up listening to him and getting to tour with him was pretty incredible. Some of the first shows were in front of like 60,000 people. That was pretty surreal.
Pretty, you know? Pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
wow.
Definitely a cool experience for sure.
Very cool, man. What were, man, you're like such an optimistic guy. You have like very great energy. I feel like awkward asking you this question. So if you're uncomfortable, let me know. What were some of the lower points or the more challenging times of your career, and how did you manage to get through them?
Well, I think knowing that I was a good player and talking about, again, the 90s, which was kind of like you dropping a nuclear bomb on the Sunset Strip, where all the classic rock and metal and all that stuff was created and kind of a mecca for, which was just kind of stuff I grew up listening to and dreamt about playing and on a high, bigger level. Going through the 90s was very depressing. After I left Quiet Riot, was forming my own band, but I didn't know what to do. What label was going to sign us? What do I do with this? We haven't had a hard time finding drummers and singers. It was me and a guitar player forming the band.
Everybody has drummers is always like, what is the deal?
Drummer is so important to a band. Like, and I think the person that realizes that the most is the bass player. If you don't have a good drummer, you can't play. It doesn't matter how good the bass player is, you just can't play. So the drummer is such an important part of a band. And I think a great example of that is when Bruce Dickinson left Maiden and they toured without, I went to see them and I was like, man, the driving force of Nico McBrain and Steve Harris was just like so powerful that I was just like, oh my God, that is such a huge part of that band that, it's not just the only time, but just being a musician and playing with people, I realized that it's important. So finding, I think the good drummers, they get work. If they're reliable people, they're busy, they get big gigs. So finding a guy off the street that's an amazing drummer, it's tough. It's
because the good ones are all usually working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, what was your question?
It was like, what were some of the lower points and how'd you get through them?
Oh, lower points. Yeah, I got sidetracked. Sorry. Well, that was in the 90s, and at that point, going like, what do I do? Well, how do I get work? And a lot of these bands are disappearing, and the bands that I could get work from, they're now broken up. They're not even playing at all, like the majority of them. Majority of them are like back together now, so it's a different story.
Yeah.
So that was rough. But I just said, like, listen, I'm just going to be a musician. I'm going to make a living playing music. So I would pick up the phone. I would place ads in magazines and, you know, papers, which, you know, there's no internet really back then. And people would call me and go like, hey, I got a gig for you. Okay, cool. Do you play jazz? Sure. So I'm driving to the show going like, what did I just tell this guy? Like, and so I get on stage and go like, oh man, this is going to be a disaster. And it was like, turned out to be like, dude, no worries. Here's a chord chart. Just play simple. And I'm like, oh, this is great. So it was like lounge, kind of smooth jazz kind of stuff. I'm like, I can do this. And then, you know, I knew how to create like walking bass lines, and I knew some jazz standards and things like that. I'm like, this is great, you know, and I kind of grew from there. And then from that, I got, you know, the guy in that band had a reggae band. So I played in his reggae band, and then they played Latin kind of stuff. And before I knew it, I was getting calls from all sorts of, you know, different, you know, reggae and Latin bands, and I played a lot of blues, just a ton of blues gigs, and which really was healthy, you know, creating and learning how to walk and create bass lines over a simple chord progression, and everything derives from the blues and all the classic rock and metal and all that stuff. So that was really helpful, and So I just kind of went that route, but it was rough. It was rough financially. Yeah. It was some of the gigs paid very, very little. And it was just the whole climate was very, very dark and depressing in the 90s. And I think it was just so coming out of that in the early 2000s, I started playing with the Robin McCauley, and we had a band called Bleed together. He was a really cool guy. We became friends, and the band was amazing. The guitar player that formed the band with him was actually a guy that I met that was auditioning for my band a few years before that, ended up not getting the gig. And so when I get an email from him saying, hey, do you want to be in me and Robin's band? I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, I said, sure, you know. And so that was kind of a turnaround point for me where I was like, well, it's fun again. I'm enjoying, yeah. I'm playing the music I want to play. I'm back on my feet again. But, you know, you just got not give up and you learn from your whole experience and of stuff. And also in the 90s, I'd go all over the place and I do a lot of recording sessions and studios everywhere. And that was a great learning process, you know, recording with all kinds of bands and playing a lot of pop and funk and you know, blues rock and metal, obviously. So it was, you know, I took it for what it was, and I was like, what else am I going to do? You know, I want to be a musician. So that was a little bit more of a definitely session period for me, you know, although I played with my own band and we played shows and we recorded and stuff like that. It was more of that than ever for me.
Man, thank you. And I give you credit, though. You made shit happen. I put out ads. And I said yes to every opportunity. You know, you didn't have an ego about it. You said, hey, man, uh-huh. I need to work. And if I need to play, you know, reggae gigs at a bar mitzvah or whatever it is, that's great, you know, because I need to get working. And it grew from there, you know. One thing about the music business, it seems very, if you're playing sincerely, very few things that guys do, when I say guys, I mean guys and gals, players, very few things players do don't lead to something else positive.
Very true.
Yeah, you know, even if it's a succession or even if it's several years later, it's always seems like, you know, if you're playing sincerely and you're doing what you're supposed to do, it somehow always seems to come back and benefit you, which is very nice.
Well, I think so now more than ever, because a lot of stuff is documented online, so that people will see videos and albums that you played on and stuff like that. So it goes into like a little nice collection or a library of information that people can look up when they go like, who's this guy? And they look and go like, oh, wow, cool.
Yeah.
So, and I noticed that with myself and I go like, oh Lord, you know, it's a lot of stuff on up there now, you know? And, so.
Which is great.
It is good. So I think like, and just doing a good job, even if you play in front of two people or you're not feeling well and you don't think the whatever jam session you're doing matters, you should never have that attitude, in my opinion. Just always do your best and you know, and stay positive. But, you know, on the same token, I've realized that as a musician, it's rough too. Where you can play an arena tour, you get off the road and the phone's not ringing. Part of it is that people think you're busy. They go, oh no, he's out with that, you know.
Yeah.
We're not going to call him. We're not going to bother him. That's part of it. Part of it too, it's like more than any other business, it's like it doesn't snowball as much. And I've had this conversation with many other musicians, you know, that are at a high level, and it's weird.
It is. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it does, but it's
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You almost have to be the aggressor and go out there and say, hey, listen, I'm available. Oh really? Oh, that's cool. And I even realized that back in years ago when I was doing a lot of session work and stuff like that, I'd make a call and pick up the phone and call somebody and go like, hey, how's it going? And he goes, oh, good to hear from you. By the way, I got a gig for you. I'm like, wow, there you go. It works.
Yeah, I would say not almost. You have to be the aggressor.
Yeah.
But I think what's different is like coming out of the business world, that's what you do. I've done that for 20 years since I've been working for myself. I think in the music industry, nobody clues you guys into this.
Yeah.
And so it's like, and for whatever reason, musicians tend to be uncomfortable selling themselves at all.
Mm-hmm.
Very, yeah. I mean, like painfully uncomfortable sometimes, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
you know,
fortunately, and it's also the expectations of people expect the musicians to be humble and careful. And so when you do, it's talk and you talk business with people, it's like you always feel like they think you're like the a-hole, you know, and it's that's, you know, so it makes all the sense in the world to have a manager that handles like that.
Okay. Now I understand that because a lot. Okay. Thank you. Because I hear so many complaints about managers.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they're all bad. Of course, there's plenty of good ones, but I've heard a lot of complaints, but now I understand why in spite of the complaints, it's just easier because in theory, they're serving that marketing function for you.
Yeah.
So I totally get that.
Well, I think it's very difficult to find the right manager, to find somebody who's good and aggressive, who's not busy managing bigger artists.
Right.
That's like finding the best, most amazing, famous drummer to play on your album that's available. Like we talked about before.
Yeah.
It's that you got to be, you keep searching and be a little lucky.
Do you know another Swedish guy? Do you know Django, Nicholas Kallgren from Truck Fighters? No. He's another guy. They're a really successful band in like stoner rock niche. And they've been around, they've had like a 10 album run, but I interviewed him and the same thing. They had like four or five drummers in the whole. And he goes, it was kind of the joke with us. Like we just, you know, it was like him and the bass player always. And it was like a different drummer every kind of album or two. It was just funny.
Right.
Did you grow up in a small town? You said you did grow up in a small town.
I did. Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
It was good. I mean, I played a lot of sports and I didn't grow up around a musically active family at all. It was, you know, it was more sports and focus on school and stuff like that. So I'm not going to even say that I was a rebel. I think I could have used a little bit of musical inspiration and guidance at home and support maybe. But I also think that a lot of things that are, we want to do are, you know, come from within.
Yeah.
Really do. I think I had a good childhood. I mean, it was pretty amazing. Back then, Sweden was very safe. It's still, well, it's not nearly as safe, but it's still a good place in some neighborhoods. But it was very, very safe where I grew up. And you stay out late at night. There's no weirdos out that could hurt children, stuff like that, almost at all. You rarely, very rarely, almost never heard about anything.
That's great.
Yeah, so it was great. And I had a lot of playgrounds and couple of lakes, like just within 5-minute walk from
like fishing lakes or boating.
Fishing lakes, boats,
really, that's water, so cool. Ski.
And it was pretty incredible. We had like, you know, playgrounds and soccer fields, and we played a lot of street hockey. And in winter, we'd play ice hockey. You know, they would make ice, and it was pretty incredible, pretty perfect environment to grow up in, really. And although it was a small city, it really didn't feel like a hick town. You know, it was a modern, you know, pretty good mentality kind of place. So,
that's great.
So the culture step going from there to here wasn't as huge as people would think, you know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, in that sense, no. Yeah, I'm good.
I was going to say, I figured you had a good child because usually you're not, you know, when you have a healthy childhood, that's what the product of that is, the guy who says, you know, I knew what I wanted to do and nothing was going to stop me and I'm okay doing this, that, and the other thing. You know, that's usually correlated to at that young of an age. What kind of work did your folks do?
My dad was a high school teacher. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. So,
very cool, man.
Yeah.
This is like an ignorant question. What kind of sports did you play there? I'm just curious what sports young kids play there.
I played almost just, except for in school and in my free time and stuff like that, mainly soccer. you know, when I played some ice hockey in the winter and stuff like that, but I was never like on a team. I was never a good skater. And I skied a lot actually in the winter. And we'd go travel up to, you know, northern Sweden and had, you know, we had a lot of fun. So that's cool.
I think do they have Epcot out there? Disney World, you know, Epcot?
Well, no, we don't. I think there's one in Paris from what I heard. But
there's one here.
I don't think, yeah.
In Florida, there's one. And they have these countries, and I think it's Sweden. It might be Norway. I apologize. But I thought it might have been Sweden. And they always have this like beautiful selection of like ski wear. Which is funny that they're selling it in Florida because like the temperature never drops below 60 degrees here.
I know, right?
And I'm always in there. I'm like, man, this stuff is gorgeous. I wish I would ever have a reason to buy it because it's
hilarious.
It's really pretty stuff. I guess, I don't know. Maybe if somebody comes from Minnesota there and they want to buy, I don't know, but it's just
to be, yeah. But how much do they sell? That's a really big question.
And it's really pretty stuff, man. Hanna Hansen, is that Swedish? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. That's the name of the company.
That was a big brand growing up. I don't know if it's Swedish or Europe somewhere. Yeah. Hansen might be Danish.
Maybe like Danish. It. Yeah. It's just really cool clothes, man. What you play so many genres, but I knew your primary thing is playing in the metal hard rock genre. Is that your favorite music to listen to as well?
It can be. I definitely was growing up. Nowadays, I like Silence.
Oh, good for you, man.
Yeah, I like Silence. I like probably classical music is probably a lot of times the most enjoyable form of music. If I had to pick one, I mean, I kind of like everything. Hmm. You know, a good song's a good song. And so it's very hard for me to really pick anything anymore. And I think part of that is, I hate to say it, but out of a lot of the new rock and metal bands coming out, I just don't hear too much that is here to stay, stuff that's too unique. And part of it is that it's a lot of bands follow trends, and even the ones that don't so much, the music just sounds too polished and too perfect to me. You know, you're replacing drums, you're lining things up, you're editing things, and there's no room for people just to play when they track stuff together like they used to do back in the day. And I can feel that when I listen to music, and it just kind of, to me, it just feels different, you know?
Sure. I totally get that, man.
Interesting
how many guys I've met that play, you know, loud music, for lack of a better term, whether it's, you know, rock, metal, hardcore, and they're really into classical. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, I hear that so many times. It's interesting.
I think a lot of it is the, melody of metal music. There's always been a focus on melody, stuff like that. I think that might be part of it, but. Yeah.
Is there any advice you would have given to your younger self if you had the opportunity that might have helped you?
Maybe to just stay true to myself at all times. There's situations where I wish I would have spoken up instead of like just, you know, dealing with crap, so to speak. When you're in that situation, you do it because you feel like you need the money and you need the gig and stuff like that. But looking back, I think it can be pretty unhealthy too, but just staying true to yourself, I think, as far as stylistically and who you are as a player and it goes with all areas of life, whether it's, meeting the right companion or meeting the right friends or doing the things in life that you want to do. You know, I think that's, I pretty much have for a big portion of my life, but there's been, I probably could have been at times more true to myself.
Yeah. You seem like someone who's been pretty true to yourself, actually.
Yeah. Thanks.
Anybody that influences your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
Well, I don't think you can hear it in my playing. I mean, I like Michael Mannering is plays a lot of fretless and different tunings and stuff like that. I enjoy listening to him. J- Jonas Hellborg, which is actually a Swedish bass player. He's very unique, and he kind of plays whatever comes to mind, which I really respect with him. Marcus Miller is a great bass player, which I like because he plays musically cool stuff. He has great technique, but he doesn't use it to impress people. He composes great music and plays for the song, which I respect. I think people might be surprised to hear that. Layers, but
why do I know Jonas Hellborg? That name sounds so familiar. Has he played in any bands or?
I think he played with John McLaughlin. He played with who else did he play with? Some pretty heavy names, actually. He played had some projects with the Johansson brothers from Yngwie's band and stuff like that. They did some experimental stuff, so they're good friends and stuff. But yeah.
This is like a unfair question almost because you've jammed with like so many good guys. If you name a couple of guitarists you really enjoyed jamming with, and is there another one or two you'd like to jam with?
Oh. Joe Satriani I would like to play with. And he seems like a really nice guy too. That's a good question. There's probably many.
Yeah.
One that would come to mind. Eddie Van Halen, obviously.
Very cool. How about people you've enjoyed jamming with?
Many people, actually, a lot of unknown people that are just wonderful players, guitar players. He's not unknown. Roland Robertson used to play with Dio. He's one of my favorite people to play with and jam with Rob Math, that used to be in my band Soul Sign. It's a great player.
Man, I was referred
to the band player.
somebody referred me to him ages ago. I'm trying to think who, but yeah, Rob Math.
Yeah, just incredible. And I've been fortunate to play with a lot of just amazing guitar players, within different styles, rock, blues, all kinds of stuff. So yeah, been very fortunate.
Blues. Who do you like playing with in blues genre?
Oh, I don't think there's any names that you would know. In fact, Rob Math is a great blues player. I mean, very, very bluesy player, I would say. Just did a gig with a wonderful player, Thomas Larsson. He's a Swede. He used to play with Glenn Hughes for years. He's located in Sweden. Great guy. This astounding player, but one of the best blues players I've ever heard in my life. Highly recommended. He's kind of like a Gary Moore meets Jeff Beck, but
holy shit.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy that you mentioned both those guys' names. Wow. That's
should check them out.
Yeah. I'm going to Larsen.
Yeah. We played a song called Road, that off of one of his albums. And I would say, check that one out first.
It's on YouTube.
It should be on YouTube. It's definitely on Spotify, but
great.
Most likely on YouTube too.
Do you remember the first CD or record that you purchased?
I don't. I think maybe Paul Stanley's solo record or something like that. I was very young. I was like maybe 6 years old, something like that. It might have been the first. My aunt used to buy cassettes and records and stuff for me and my brothers for our birthdays. But I don't remember which the first one was. And we were very little when she started doing that. So that was pretty cool. Good, really good question. I should know the answer to that one, but
it's a tough one, man.
Desert
Island Discs, no particular order. Just for right now, top three. What would you pick? Knee-jerk reaction. Top three Desert Island Discs, top three records you'd take to a desert island.
Oh my god. Wow. I'd say maybe Led Zeppelin 2. Power Slave with Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden, yeah.
And oh, that's a tough one. What would the third one be?
ABBA. You mentioned ABBA earlier. No, I'm just kidding.
Earth, Wind, and Fire and Verdant White is probably one of my one of that people would be surprised that I you know, am bass players that influenced me. Maybe Earth, Wind, and Fire best of album, something like that. Maybe, I don't know.
Very cool.
That's a very good question.
This is a tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself?
Wow. I have pretty good intuition. What I like the least is that I probably haven't listened to it enough.
Very, very honest, man. Thank you. That's a very, yeah. How come you haven't listened to it?
I think that the analytical mind, and it's a challenge of like, I think I can figure out a better answer. I'm going to try to challenge that to see what happens. And like, yeah, I think there's another solution. A lot of things that come to me, I don't even know. Yeah. But I keep telling people it's stupid. The intuition is the smartest one because it's got to figure it out already. Mm. You just got to listen to it. Mm. No matter how weird it seems, that can't be right. That just doesn't seem right when you start to analyze it. But it's already been figured out. So I just go, hey, I'm just going to go for it, listen to it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, more so now than ever, you know.
Yeah, you got to stay in touch with that guttural instinct for sure.
Yeah.
Man. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Wow. Well, I spent most of my childhood as a soccer goalie.
That is interesting.
Yeah, and after discovering, you know, Kiss when I was 6, 7 years old, I listened to top 40 music most of my, you know, till I was like maybe 12. So for about 5, 6 years, I listened more to pop music than rock and metal. So that's probably surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah. You know what? People in your age bracket, Kiss is the number one band that motivated people to play music and get into playing guitar and play rock. It's really interesting. And people like in their mid-60s, it's the Beatles.
Right.
Yeah. All the time. Yeah. And I'm sort of like in the middle.
And then you're just, and the people in the middle are, it seems like there's a lot of Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin in there.
Yeah, there is a lot of that. Yeah. But it's interesting how many people Kiss was the trigger for. I mean, like, it's like really a high percentage.
Oh, huge.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Hey, man, what's your favorite American food? I mean, you've been here a long time, so there's probably nothing like.
Oh, wow. Just a good steak, I think. Definitely.
You know what? Most of the guys in Sweden, that's what they say.
Yeah.
A good steak. It's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like a couple, it's all always beef, like, or, you know, meat, barbecue, you know, it's always something like that.
In Sweden, I like after moving here, I just realized how much pork people eat in Sweden. It's unbelievable.
Interesting. It's
and even meat, like the meat sauce, the meat and the meat sauce is made with pork. Everything is made with pork.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable. And I'm surprised people don't have more heart attacks.
Yeah.
With you. Just very, very unhealthy, a lot of it. Like a lot of really fat sausages. There's one sausage that's from my neck of the woods, Sweden, and it's just, it's got to be 90% fat. It's so good. It's amazingly one of the best. But it's just, I look at it and go like, dude, people should not eat.
But I bet you they're so much more active there.
Very true. People ride the bicycles. Well, they used to. Now the kids grown up is a different story, but that's a big problem.
Yeah.
And my older brother's actually doing a lot of research about this, you know, and what's this very healthy in the lifestyle of kids and trying to get them to be more active and all that stuff. But yeah, I think the cold weather too, people burn off calories and they need it to stay warm, and they always did. So Yeah. You're right. I think people burn it off. And people play, growing up, people, not only riding the bicycle, people played a lot of sports too. A lot of sports growing up, like, and constantly active, you know, and then so.
Well, especially soccer is one of the most cardiovascular demanding sports around, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, football, American football is nowhere near as demanding as cardio-wise as soccer is, you know, not even
close. And whenever I watch a soccer game, I'm going like, man, these guys are running for 90 minutes.
It's incredible, man. I mean, the cardio shape they're in is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Favorite Swedish food that you miss?
I don't know. I can't tell you. A lot of it, you know, there's a lot of different stuff that's good, but nothing in particular, really. There's so much good stuff here that in L.A., there's so much international food that's great. You know, I just had Vietnamese food yesterday that was just incredible.
Yeah.
And, so I hate to say it. I don't miss anything too much. But of course, anytime when I go back and, you know, my mom cooks or whatever, and it's like, oh, my God, here's this stuff again. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of good food back there for sure.
Person who's had the biggest influence on you, both musically and personally?
Oh, wow. Musically, Yngwie Malmsteen is probably one of them growing up. Playing, learning his music and appreciating him as a musician. And Billy Sheehan is probably another one who, not just stylistically, but as far as just setting the bar high, showing the world that this is humanly possible, you know, and I think that's a big one. And his work ethics was always inspirational to me. Obviously, I mean, you know, his style and his playing and all that stuff. And I kind of, with anything, like, years ago started, you know, well, I think I never really sat down and copied stuff too much. I think part of it is I was too lazy. And I was also going like, well, I'm never going to be, you know, as much as I love like Steve Harris, for example, of Iron Maiden, I'm like, I'm never going to play an Iron Maiden. Why would I learn the whole Power Slave record? What's the point? I mean, it's enjoyable playing some of that stuff, but I just kind of was more realistic about stuff. I'd rather play all sorts of songs from different albums and different bass players and stuff like that. But as far as Billy Sheehan, I'd kind of learned some of his techniques and I learned some of the licks and stuff like that. But then when you try to copy somebody too much, you just end up sounding like them, you know, too much. I mean, a little bit, you can hear with people in people's playing like, oh, I can tell that this and that guy is influenced and grew up listening to certain people or whatever. But then it gets to a point where you just have to start listening to yourself, I think, and one trick is like you sit down and you improvise and you record yourself and you listen back to that and you go like, what was that? And then you learn the little things that you just accidentally played or, you know.
Man, and I need to start doing that, actually.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
That's a little trick that Craig Goldie actually taught me 25 years ago. He talked about that, and I never really kind of did it too much, but when I would record myself, I would listen and go like, well, that's interesting. And I think just in my mind I started hearing these phrasings and these things that kind of stuck, you know. So,
and how about personally, biggest influence on you?
A friend of mine that was also a bass player and a producer back in the day that passed away about 12 years ago was really a good friend and gave me a lot of good advice about life. You know, he was ill for a long time, terminally ill. And
Sorry, man.
So he had a really positive outlook on life. He said, I had a great life and I can't complain. I'm very happy about my life. It's okay to die. And he said, you know, he just had a lot of good advice about, you know, your approach to life as far as like enjoy life and all that kind of things, and just the attitude about certain situations, whether it was like, you know, being nervous about it, playing a show, or, you know, relationship issues with, you know, we talked about everything, and he was really a great support to me, you know. Around that time in my life too was, you know, was a little bit of a more difficult time for me as well. So definitely a huge inspiration.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, man.
Oh, thank you.
What's your biggest business or personal win?
business, I nothing.
Yet.
I can't think of one thing, to be honest with you. Personal win, I think maybe getting the gig with Yngwie was kind of like a good career changing thing where, you know, it sort of snowballed into a lot of other things.
Right.
So personally and business wise.
You have any hobbies or stuff you do outside of music?
Not enough. I like to go hiking and, you know, do and just enjoy life and go to the beach and stuff like that. I don't really have too many things that I, outside of that, just relaxing things.
There's plenty of that, beach and hiking, both in LA, I would imagine. No.
Oh my God. Yeah. Paradise for that.
Yeah. Talk about a specific experience that changed your life or changed the way you think about things.
Wow.
It's a very American interview, isn't it? If I ask these questions in Sweden, would people like, what the hell? That's none of your business. Right?
No, I think they'd be very open to it. They may not be used to it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, in all fairness, I was like a little, that's why I always tell like everybody, you know, hey, look, here's the questions ahead of time. Maybe if you want to check out an episode or whatever. But when I interviewed like three or four guys in Sweden and then like a couple of guys from Netherlands.
Yeah.
And like some of the questions, I was like, oh shit, I hope they don't think I'm like being rude. And everybody answered everything. They were like champions, man. I was like, you know, and some of the guys I knew, they were a little uncomfortable. And so afterwards, you know, I was like, hey, you know, I felt you were a little uncomfortable. Thank you so much. And I was a little uncomfortable, but, you know, I wanted to like get out of my comfort zone. You know, I just wanted to do this, you know, whatever. So it was,
right.
But I always try to preface people that are not like from, I mean, you've been here long enough, so it's not probably a surprise to you, but that, you know, this isn't, you know, like if I'm talking to someone from Germany, hey man, this is not it's just like a little more personal than you probably get involved with in Germany or wherever.
Right. They want you to be like more direct.
Yeah. You know, like we can't talk about that, you know. Yeah. Anyway, specific experience that changed your life or altered the way you think about things. And it could be any experience.
Oh wow. You know, it's there's many, I think. I think any time I've had, maybe a relationship breakup, something like that, makes you look at things differently. A lot of times, obviously being in America when 9/11 hit, that was a pretty devastating thing. I mean, it's a funny thing too, like talking about disasters when the 1994 earthquake hit here, I wasn't afraid at all. I thought it was I loved it. I was like, this is cool, you know? And then I was like, okay, I'm going back to bed. And everybody's like, no, we got to evacuate the building. I'm like, oh, come on, I got to sleep, you know? So
I'm not going to let a little earthquake bother me.
I was waiting for an earthquake. I was like, man, I want to experience one. And then it hit.
Wow.
Like, great, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
But you know, a lot of people were like devastated, and I didn't understand why, but I mean, I did after I saw the damages and stuff over the buildings. It was pretty bad, but and after that, I think it was things like that make you realize how fragile we are and what things that can happen, you know. And I had a friend of mine that, you know, died in a car accident. He was also one of a really good friend and a mentor and all that kind of stuff of mine. And he, I get a call one day and from his sister, stuff like that, you know, things like life changing things like that makes you just reflect and think about stuff and appreciate life and stuff like that. I think I have many, I can't think of one thing really that, really, kind of changed things like that too much.
No, usually it's many. I mean, I think like in a television show, you see the one thing, but I think in reality of life, with everybody's got stuff going on all the time, that's going to have an impact on you, you know, and hopefully it's not too severe that it's like that one thing that, you know, unless it's good, hopefully, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And last question, man. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been deliberate and how much is just a natural occurrence through aging?
I think that I've definitely been more honest with myself and true to myself, and honest about the fact that, you know, people in general can be a certain way, and to not necessarily trust people and to trust my instinct. A lot of those things have really helped me, I think, and made me grow in a direction that I wanted to grow.
For you, man. Dude, I can't thank you enough for sharing all this stuff and some cool stories and being so open. Let me tell people where to find you. First of all, if you haven't heard Bjorn play, he's an amazing bass player. Let me spell his name. It's Bjorn, B-J-O-R-N, Englund, E-N-G-L-E-N. So go to bjornenglund.com, B-J-O-R-N-E-N-G-L-E-N. He's got a lot of cool merchandise on there. Also, he does lessons, which is pretty cool. So if you want to take lessons from a guy who's played with like this, everybody in metal and is a very seasoned both touring and session player, two ways. You can go to his website and go to the contact tab there, or you can email him directly at lessons@bjornenglund.com. Lessons at, and I'll spell it one last time, B-J-O-R-N-E-N-G-L-E-N. He also does bass tracks, as he mentioned, and if you're interested in having him work on some tracks for you, again, hit him up on his contact tab. And man, I didn't realize this. He also has a line of signature strings, bass strings, and then a line of signature cables. So you want to talk about those and, like, you know, what makes those different than other cables and strings?
Yeah, the bass strings I played for about 21 years, and they're made by Daniel Mari in New York, and whose father started Labella, and he left and started his own company. And Daniel Mari is his name. He's 91 now, but he's still going at it, working, and he's a great guy. We became really good friends over the years, and he's helped set up many string factories for Fender, for many companies, and everybody knows him in the string industry, and he's sort of like a grandfather of string making, and used to hand make and hand deliver strings to both John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix. So,
wow.
Yeah. And he lived very close to John Lennon as well. They were almost neighbors, and he still lives there actually. So
up on like Central Park West or something like that.
Yep. Yeah. West. Exactly. So yeah, very cool. And the strings are stainless steel, and in my opinion, nickel sometimes would maybe last longer, but these strings last a long time. I've never had a set that's inconsistent. They always sound the same. They're very consistent across the neck, and very good strings, and very reasonably priced too. Not just my signature strings, but all the Mari strings are typically lower price range than most strings. And my strings are different, that you have the E string is a little thicker because I use a D tuner to flip the tuning down. And when you do that, a string gets floppy, and then you get a lot of string rattling and things like that. But if the string's a little thicker, it'll stay tighter, and it'll remain a lot of that same intonation and a lot of the same characteristics of the sounds, you know, without getting too much noise going on. And then the high string is just a tiny bit thinner than the normal gauge, just to allow for more bending, better bending and stuff like that. Other than that, it's a normal gauge. Like, it's typically like a 45, 65, 85, 105, which is very like a normal medium set. Some people like to put 80s on the A string. I don't. I'd like the 85s. That's a personal preference, but those are cool. You can get those on my website, or they're even on Amazon and eBay as well.
Very cool. And it'll say it's your name, Bjorn Englund Strings, Signature Strings.
Yeah, you could put 108 as the model, 108 strings as well.
Awesome. And talk about your cables, man.
The cables are made by Spectraflex out of Florida, actually. So
where out of Florida?
They're down in wet northwest Florida. I forget the
northwest,
Lake something.
Lake Wales?
Fulton Lake, something like that. No.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Man, there's not too much industry in northwest Florida. I mean, it's mostly tourism industry up there, like Destin and all those places.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but very, very good cables. I, to be honest, never broke any of them. And I've used them since 2008 and have been on the road with me, run over by huge racks and cabinets and stuff like that. I've been wheeled over them. They've been, you know, abused and never had one single cable fail.
So dude, that's pretty tremendous. Since 2008?
Since 2008.
Wow, that's 10 years.
Yep. And
that's longer than most marriages last.
Right?
Right.
Very, very true. And very durable. And the material, too, is feels very clean. It doesn't get, like, dirty and nasty. And they're easy to wrap. They don't get tangled up and weird and stuff like that as much as cables normally do. So highly recommended.
Very cool.
Find those on my website as well, and on the Spectraflex website. You can find them, and I believe they're on eBay as well.
Awesome, dude, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. Any you going out on tour soon, or anything, any shows you want to promote?
I got some tentative stuff coming up this year that haven't been confirmed, so I don't want to mention any of that, but looks like we're going to be going back out with Dear Disciples in the early spring, and possibly bringing the Hologram around the U.S.
Awesome.
For about 6 weeks. So that's also not confirmed and could change, but that would be amazing. And then looking to do more clinics, and possibly going back to Sweden and Europe pretty soon to do more of that as well over there. So.
Very cool. And you have any social media that you want to direct people to? Instagram?
I do. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It's all Bjorn Englund. So you'll find me there, and I'm active, and I'll see the tweets. I'll stay pretty. I stay pretty connected to that. So that's a good way to keep track of me and get in touch with me as well.
Very cool, man. And support Bjorn and his music, and check out his bass signature strings and guitars, piano, keyboard, or bass players. Check out his signature cables. Man, thank you very much. I appreciate everything, Bjorn. Been awesome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, share it with your friends on social media. We appreciate your support. And thanks again to Bjorn Englund for spending time with us. Again, check him out online, BJORNENGLEN. And make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. You get advance notice of guests coming on the show and the opportunity to ask your own questions. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.